Support for this public radio podcast comes from AIG Travel Guard, providing travel insurance designed to help travelers face the unexpected. Learn more at travelguard.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. Coming up, the story of a polar explorer and his determination to engage people about the dangers of global warming. Will Steger made his first trip to the North Pole over 20 years ago. He has since crossed Antarctica, and he just about died in a solo Arctic trek after that. Will was thinking of retiring as an explorer when the news broke of the old ice shelves collapsing. Since then, he's been taking young explorers out on the land, inspiring them to lead the fight against global warming. Well, you'd think that these days, with sat phones and GPS gizmos, it might be easier than it was in years past. Well, you try hauling sledges up a frozen waterfall.
1, 2, 3.
Ah! So it was pretty intense, and but also pretty satisfying to be able to do it and pull through all in one piece.
Climate change at the ends of the earth. That's right after the news. It's clear now that the real warning about climate change is coming most dramatically from the coldest parts of the planet. Great shelves of ice are falling into the sea at rates that weren't even predicted 20 or 10 years ago. Arctic fjords that have been locked in ice for centuries are now open. Inuit elders like Theo Ikumak are left wondering what the land will be like for their children.
For example, ice might be even be a thing of the past. Looking at our 10-year-olds, if they get to be my age, is the ice going to be there? Maybe not. And the way I look at it now, the children that we have today might be, you know, at my age level when everything is so changed that new species of animals are here, old species have moved on somewhere else, or they have been wiped out altogether. So looking at that, Inuit culture will have to be rewritten down the road.
More than Inuit culture, though, the pace of global warming is changing the planet for all of us, in ways that can't yet be measured. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
Polar exploration has always captured our imagination. Peary and Cook and their competing claims to be the first at the North Pole, the deadly race between Amundsen and Scott to get to the South Pole. Ernest Shackleton's failure to reach the South Pole was something he recorded back in 1910. He told the story of one companion who nearly fell into a crevasse.
All of a sudden, we heard a shout of help from the man behind. We looked round and saw him supporting himself by his elbows on the edge of a chasm. We rushed back and helped the man out and then hauled the sledge out. Then we lay down to have a look, but nothing but a black gulf lay below. After this, we four men had 1,000 pounds to pull, and we were unable to pull the whole load at once, so we had to relay. That is, we hauled half our load for a mile, then we walked back a mile, and then we hauled the other half up. So for every mile we gained to the south, we had to cover 3 to do it. I, Ernest Shackleton, have today, March the 30th, dictated this record.
100 years ago, these polar explorers were trying to be the first non-natives to reach the North Pole and the South Pole. More recently, such adventurers journey off in personal pursuits of endurance. Sometimes it's done to accompany tourists on such treks. But in recent years, global warming has given new urgency to this kind of polar exploration. Will Steger has done a lot of polar travel, both north and south. In 1989, he was part of a team that crossed the entire continent of Antarctica. 7 months, 3,741 miles. And for several weeks of that, Will says, his team was traversing the Larsen Ice Shelf on the Antarctic Peninsula.
It feels like land. There's no sense of any water being 300 or 400 feet underneath you. We traveled for 2 weeks across these ice shelves, and we struggled hour to hours, you know, skiing, we got a sense of how enormous these ice shelves
were. What would the distance be that you would have covered in that two-week period?
We would cover, it was about 150 miles across, a great place to travel. It's flat without crevasses. You don't have an elevation problem.
Now, you'd been warned by the British scientists to keep your eyes open for cracks in the ice shelf. Is that right?
They were talking at that time about cracks between the land and the ice shelves, but I had no idea. They literally shut the door, and they made me promise not to tell anyone what they were going to tell me. But they told me about these large cracks that were forming on the Larsen ice shelf. As long as they're there, it's like a cork in a wine bottle.
Why was it such a secret? Well, why weren't they publishing their results or talking about it out loud?
They were very open about that, about losing their funding, because their funding came from various sources. And if they were calling the alarm for global warming, they were afraid of losing the funding for their science.
Is that because back in 1988, people who banged on the table about global warming were considered to be a little bit off-center? I mean,
it was, but there was also a concerted effort there to keep this type of information, you know, out in the public.
14 years later, Will Steger was back at his country retreat in Ely, Minnesota, when news broke that one huge part of the Larsen Ice Shelf, a chunk the size of Rhode Island, had simply collapsed. Experts explained it on NPR News.
This area of the Antarctic is warming quite rapidly, something at around five times the mean global warming rate.
We got a really clear image that showed that the Larsen B was just covered with melt ponds this year. It had been a particularly warm summer. An Argentine group that was down on the ice shelf in November said they thought the spring conditions were very warm, and they kind of warned everybody to keep an eye on
it. If you like, you know, to imagine the ice shelf as a kind of brick wall, climate change, we believe, has been removing bricks one at a time every year for the past 10 or 15 years. Eventually, the ice shelf has become so weak that it's collapsed. In a structural way, the whole thing's just fallen apart.
The ice shelf just disintegrated into thousands of small icebergs on the surface of the ocean.
The explorer, Will Steger, says he couldn't believe it.
I remember reading the paper. It was on the eighth page of the paper, this headlines, Larsen B ice shelf collapses. And when I read that, that was just, that changed my life. I was shocked. I thought this was going to be two generations down, but here, right before my eyes, this is happening now, and this is serious. When I saw the headlines of the collapse, I knew I had a call to action now. I was also at the same time feeling very negative on where the country was going, and especially about the environment. And it's not unlike me to get negative, but I was right around that time I realized I'm not going to be angry here. I'm going to get back to the organizing expedition and educational project. So I decided shortly after that that I would go back into exploring again and start up the program. You know, this means leaving my comfortable home and log cabin in Ely, Minnesota, and starting up fundraising again, which I don't mind. But it meant it was a turning point in my life, and I knew that I had something to offer.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Will Steger says he was nearing 60. He'd been thinking that his exploring days were behind him. But last year, he led an expedition of young explorers across Baffin Island, stopping in at various Inuit settlements. That is, when they weren't stopped by the weather. Here's a recording from that trip made when it was only 20 degrees below zero.
Fortunately, it's not too cold, but it's really, really windy. In fact, you'll get blown down the ice if you just stand out with your arms open out here. We're slightly in the lee. Slightly. That should give you some perspective. So it's a day off today.
We got lots of food, dog food. I got no worries, except for my tent. Might blown away. We're going about, the wind's going about 80 to 70 some miles an hour sometimes. Yeah, pretty windy.
The barometer's still dropping. It's down to 963.
What is it?
963. Okay. Yeah, it's just dropping precipitously. Just down, down, down. Ever since yesterday, about 6.
It doesn't seem to be letting up. Seems to be getting worse right now. So hopefully in the next little while, it'll peak and start slowing down.
Will Steger says the Baffin Island trip was a chance for him and for his young companions to hear from the people who live there.
We traveled with three Inuit hunters, and we interviewed probably over 100 hunters and elders about global warming.
What are they telling you? What did you hear from the people on Baffin Island about the way their lives are changing?
This is a very traditional area in Baffin. They live very close to the land, and they say it's changing very quickly. In the last 3 or 4 or 5 years, what they're seeing, they've never seen before. And they're also, about 80% of the men talk about the sea ice. Now, these are marine people, but they're hunters on the ice. So they live on ice, on sea ice. And they're saying it's melting not just from the top, but from the bottom. I've heard it over and over and over from the elderly and the hunters up there.
Will Steger went on to tell me that he'd been listening to this program, The Story, a year ago when he heard one such hunter, Pitsiolak Alanga, describing his own new rules for hunting. In that conversation, Pitsiolak, or Pits as he's known, told me that he now carries a small boat on top of his sled whenever he goes out on the ice.
I've always been doing that since 1998.
I bet your father and your grandfather never took a boat out in the wintertime.
No, they didn't. Their snowmobiles were husky dogs, so the dogs were a lot smarter than the snowmobiles today.
Tell me, when you're out on the land, do you see differences in the animals?
Well, the seals, in the springtime when they're out suntanning, they like to lie on their back more and have their tummy showing to the sun. And we have caught a few seals in the past where some seals have absolutely no hair on their tummy from suntanning.
And you never would have seen that in years past?
No, we never would have seen that. And nowadays we mostly have clear skies all the time now. There's a lot less cloud. That's where the seals are getting burnt from suntanning.
And are the seals unhealthy because of this? If they don't have the hair on their stomach, does that cause a problem for them?
If the seal don't go underwater, the seal is not eating as much. And when we're cutting it up, we'll find out that the seal barely ate. It's been suntanning too long. And it wasn't looking for food most of the springtime.
What do you think is happening, Pitts? Do you think that the seal gets up in the sun and the sun warms the seal so much it gets dopey and sleepy and it just stays up there on the ice?
I have seen it in the past few springtimes where the ice is really dangerous for people to be trying to go to where the seals are. And we look at the seals through binoculars, and the ice formation is different now, so we don't even try and attempt going to those seals that are suntanning.
Just too dangerous. You can't predict what the ice would be like.
Yes.
That's Pitsiolak Alanga, the Kalawit. His description of the way that climate is changing helped inspire the polar explorer, Will Steger, to head back to the north himself and to get young people interested in the effects of global warming. In just a moment, I'll talk more with Will about his own adventures. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. I used to live in Canada's north. I know that the winter nights there are long. So long, in fact, that if you don't make a point of looking outside around lunchtime, you might not see the sun that day. And so here we have our polar explorer, Will Steger, leading expeditions of young people from Europe and Canada and the U.S. into parts of that Arctic land. They're not as cut off from the rest of the world as explorers used to be. They have satellite phones and laptops for links to the outside. But I figure that the stories of earlier exploits by Steger are also a part of the evening entertainment. Will says he was 13 years old when he was first captivated by the stars.
I used to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning with my star charts and flashlight with red cellophane over it. In the 50s, you didn't go out in your backyard. There was no problem. But I remember it was like 57 or 58, they put a street light in front of our house. And that was a major problem with me. I couldn't observe it. I had to go in the shadows of the backyard. But I was slowly, you know, experiencing light pollution.
And no one in the family turned on a bedroom light and looked out and said, yeah, Will's still out there. Not really sure why.
They weren't. Well, that's a great thing. I had parents that gave my brothers and sisters, there were 9 of us in the family, pretty much total freedom. As long as we had a certain grade point average in school, we stayed out of trouble.
Now, you and your brother went down the Mississippi at about the same age that Tom and Huck Finn were when they headed out on that river. Whose idea was that?
That was my idea. The first book that I read when I was a kid was in third grade, The Adventures of Huck Finn. I had some learning disabilities in reading, and I picked up this big book, which was pretty challenging. But once I started reading it, I just got hooked on it. It took me about a month to read it through, and I reread it and reread it. And I was totally fascinated with the Mississippi River. Now, I lived in Minneapolis, St. Paul, so the river was there. I was very much aware of that river. I was always curious where it went. But I wanted to go down the river, and that was a real statement of my parents giving us the freedom to do that. My dad.
You were how old at the time?
I was 15 when I went down the river.
And your brother Tom was?
I was 17. But I started preparing for the journey when I was 12 years old. I used to caddy, cut lawns, anywhere to make a dollar. And I bought a wooden motorboat, fixed it up, and I traded that in. It took me a couple of trade-ins by the time I had a very good vehicle when I was finally 15 years old.
How big was the boat that took you down the river?
It was 16 feet.
That's the same length as a canoe. This is not a great big craft.
Not a big craft, especially in the southern Mississippi River. But we left in June, and with our parents' blessing.
I wonder if there's a passage of Huck Finn that's a favorite of yours, one that you would either quote to school kids or one that you found particularly inspirational.
There's so many good ones. There's one in particular where they pull their raft into the slough in the early morning. And Huck is describing the sunrise and the red sunrise and the fog and the slow-moving river and also the pace of the south and the beauty of the south in the morning.
It was a monstrous big river down there. Sometimes a mile and a half wide. We run nights and laid up and hid daytimes. Soon as night was most gone, we stopped navigating and tied up, nearly always in the dead water under a towhead, and then cut young cottonwoods and willows and hid the raft with them. Then we set out the lines. Next we slid into the river and had a swim, so as to freshen up, cool off, and then we set down on the shady bottom. No a sound anywheres, perfectly still, just like the whole world was asleep. Only sometimes the bullfrogs are cluttering, maybe. Then for an hour there, wouldn't be nothing to hear, nor nothing to see. Just solid lonesomeness. Next, you'd see a raft sliding by, way off yonder. So we'd put in the day, lazying around, listening to the stillness.
It was not only the adventure of going down the river, but it was meeting the people. That's what was fascinating to me. I've always been interested in people, especially older people, getting their stories.
This was what, 1960, is that
this
right?
This is 1960, yeah.
It's the sort of thing which would be really hard to replicate today.
It would be, I think, impossible. We were in New Orleans, Tom and I, out of money, our gas. We only had a few dollars, and we were reluctant to wire home yet for more money because we had to pay it back. We met this old bum by the name of Sylvester. You know, he was probably in his 60s and very kind man. He took us under his wing, showed us how to live in the streets. I mean, this is a time when it was very safe. And about 2 o'clock in the morning, we'd go to the warehouses when they would throw out the fruit. And this one particular early morning, he found a great watermelon. So we went to the piers on the Mississippi River, and there was 3 pilings. Tallest one Sylvester sat on because he was senior. My brother Tom was the second the highest, and I was the lower tiered. So he cracked this watermelon over the pier, and he's eating this big section of this thing. And after he's done, he rubs it across his face and his bald head, and he said, "Boys, this is living.
This is your own Mark Twain moment.
Mark Twain, right? We're looking out over the Mississippi River with the barges going down in the morning, and the New Orleans is lit up in the background with the city lights. It was a really memorable occasion.
Do you put your finger on that one particular trip, Will, as a time when you decided that you wanted, for as long and as far as you could go, be just an explorer, just go places where you hadn't been before?
That's what I wanted to do, and that's how I saw my life ever since I can remember. And I've been extremely fortunate because I've had good vision. I've always known where I wanted to go. I wanted to do adventuring, live in the wilderness, and I pretty much played that out and through expeditions and through my life, you know, for the last 60 years.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Will Steger is telling me how he developed this lifelong love of adventure and exploration. It wasn't long before the challenge of the Arctic beckoned him. I asked him about his first trip to the North Pole, a trip he made 22 years ago.
Heading out to the unknown, doing something that almost everyone said was impossible, leaving the north coast of Ellesmere Island, which is the northernmost part of the continent, 72 below zero.
72 below zero. That's possible, is it?
Yep, that's okay. Possible. And you can see the steam rising up off of the dogs' bodies from the heat of their bodies and forming a cloud.
How many people are with you at this time?
We had 8 people and 49 dogs.
And this was an unsupported trip to the North Pole. Explain that for me.
Yeah, unsupported meaning that we had no outside support. We carried all of our food and gear. We did not use any type of satellite navigation. The GPS was not around at that time, but we used sextant only.
There you were gazing at the sky again.
Sky again, watching the stars. The sun was just coming back. We had at that time a short twilight of about a week and then 24-hour sun pretty much shortly after that.
And it took you how long?
It took us 56 days. It was really knocked down, drag out, very cold. 2 people were injured along the way, broken ribs and some frozen feet. But it was probably one of the toughest things I've ever done in a concentrated time. I was so determined to do it, I was not coming back. I was going to do this.
So how did you actually know you'd made it to the pole? How did you know you were there when you were there?
At the time, we had a satellite system that would send out your location to the outside. The only way you could get that location would be to call in.
Yeah, the planes in the north used to carry these electronic locator transmitters,
yes.
Right? Just a little beep, and that's how they'd find a downed plane. Same
right.
Thing?
Yeah, similar to that. The outside would have our position. So May 8th, when we felt we were there, we pushed the button. And we didn't hear back for another 2 days because of the radio blackout. After that, we slept for about 16 hours and then tried to contact the plane to pick us up. But it took us a while to get picked up after that.
But they confirmed that, yes, you were there.
They said we were within 100 meters of the pole. We couldn't believe
that's
it.
Not bad.
A little bit of luck, but I think it was really was the skill of my navigator, my partner on this trip, Paul Schurke, and he was a real brilliant man.
How tough was the travel, though? I mean, the accounts that I've read of polar travel is that, you know, sometimes you're crossing these great big crevasses, sometimes you're on ice floes that are moving. In 1986, in March, did you ever know if you were over land or over water? Was it smooth going? What did you find?
Continual unknown. I mean, this is one of the great things about the Arctic Ocean. From day to day, you never know what kind of adventure. You have wide lanes of open water that can stop you in your tracks, ridges, 40 feet high, 30 feet high, as far as you can see in the north. We were on severe rations with fuel. It's one thing if you have extra fuel to keep yourself warm, but we had only enough fuel to melt our snow in the water and cook our meals, so you couldn't dry off your clothing. It was very, very cold. Our sleeping bags filled with ice. In the last week or so, we basically went almost without sleep, 20-hour days. We sleep for a little bit, and then this is traveling with very, very little food. It was really tough going, and we didn't know right into that last day whether or not we were going to make it.
One of the reasons why I want to ask you about your 86 trip to the pole and your 97 trip in the Canadian Arctic is I'm curious to know if you were at that time, Will, noticing significant differences in the climate up there. I understand that they are different times of the year, and maybe that made comparison just about impossible, but were you in 97 saying, hey, you know, this is not what I expected, or there should be more ice, that sort of thing?
When we went to the North Pole in 86, that was pretty much a normal winter. We started to see the changes in 1995. The surface of the Arctic Ocean in the winter was totally changing. We had more open water in many of those days in 95 than we did on the whole expedition in 86. That's very noticeable.
In 86, you left Ellesmere Island and headed from there to the North Pole. The ice that you crossed at that time, What would it look like if we were up there today?
If you were in that area where we launched that expedition, it would be, well, right now there'd be some pack ice in it, but in the summer it's open water now. That disintegrated that section.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. As he mentioned a moment ago, the explorer, Will Steger, did another high Arctic run 10 years later. This time, he would start at the North Pole and make his way south. That trip didn't end so well.
In 1997, my goal was to do a solo in the summertime from the pole south. I hitchhiked on a Russian icebreaker, nuclear icebreaker, to the pole. It was filled with tourists, and they dropped me off at the North Pole in July.
I can see the look on the faces of the Russian tourists going bye-bye.
When they dropped me off, most of the people thought they'd never see me again. I mean, they were really concerned. I mean, looking back at this, I'm actually surprised I took this on. The problem I had was incredibly thick fog. I've never seen anything like that. You know, you could maybe see 6-7 feet in front of you.
And what were you navigating with in 97?
Yeah, 97, I had a GPS, so I could tell if I was drifting or not. I knew exactly where I was at. But what happened there, my communication to the outside was through a satellite system. And normally I would travel with a group of six, and I was usually not the technical person, so I was pretty new with this equipment. The satellite system went down, being blank. I was drifting in this fog. No one knew where I was. There was no way anyone could ever find me out there. And it was pretty sobering. I ended up figuring out, you know, after 3 days what was wrong with it. But I basically had to call in a rescue.
You think you were going to die out there?
For a short period of time, you know, I really had to come to grips with myself. I was really stressed out. I had almost like a pneumonia symptom. So, but I knew I'd been in these situations before, and I just kind of kept my pace and got my head back together and slowly got the communications going, and then I basically organized my own rescue. I thought at that time, I thought this was the end of my career. I mean, I'd quit on the spot. I mean, I just knew right there that was it, and I was picked up okay without any incident, without causing any problems to anybody. And then I quit major expeditions. I never thought I'd come back again.
But Will Steger is back and exploring the Canadian Arctic with younger companions. He says it's his way to draw attention to the crisis of global warming. You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. The latest news, reported just this morning, is that the Arctic Ocean could be free of ice in the summertime as early as the year 2013. Will says the climate changes are best understood through the people who are living with them.
Last year in the Baffin expedition, we had the three hunters that were in their 50s and 60s, and they were basically our eyes and ears because we came upon open stream in March. Didn't think much of it. It was open. They were just couldn't believe it. They've never
running water in March was something they'd not
March,
seen.
But,
yeah?
But they've hunted there for 50 years, but they go back to traditional knowledge where their fathers had ancestry,
there,
and they've never seen this particular stream open. I mean, just Cumberland Sound, which is like 40 miles across, maybe 80, 90 miles long.
Yeah, it's huge.
Completely broke up in January. And they would say, no, they've never seen Cumberland Sound open at that time of the year. And what was different, they said it wasn't from the wind. It was large swells that came from the ocean.
So do you hear from them, Will, a sense of despair over how quickly the climate is changing in their part of the world?
Well, in general, the Inuit people that I talk to in Baffin do have a concern about the melting ice and for their children, but you push them a little bit on it, and they'll say they're not worried because they can't worry about something they can't change. And almost all will say, we're an adaptable people. Sea level goes up, we'll move our towns, and if the ice disappears, we'll hunt. And the majority of them will turn the question around, how will your culture adapt when global warming comes south? And I think that's
tough question, though.
It's coming.
How do you make a difference, though, Will? Because I know a lot of people ask themselves this question. I know you have training as a teacher, and I know that you have kind of national, international profile that gives you the opportunity to speak to people as an explorer and as an adventurer and as a scientist. But really, how do you make a difference?
You make a difference. I've been fortunate because I've been in my life faced with overwhelming odds. It could be raising money or exploring, and I I knew by, you know, stick-to-ing it, you can do it. But this is a question that we all face. It's human nature to put our heads in the sand when faced with something as large as global warming. But we first have to take self-initiative and empower ourselves. If we want to find out something, it's like when I was young, I wanted to find out about the stars. I had an interest. I empowered myself. We all can do that around global warming in our own sphere. The second is to mobilize ourselves, to organize ourselves with groups.
Do you think that the capacity is there, personally, on your shoulders, or even more generally, to actually make a difference? Because I know from many of the conversations that I have with people, Will, there's a sense of the barn door's open, the horse has left. It's yeah. It's more a matter of trying to ameliorate the damage rather than turning anything around. There, I do hear a kind of, it's too late, we screwed it up.
My faith is in the young people. I mean, that's not just a cliche. Our main goal on this next expedition, I'm traveling with six 21 to 28-year-olds from four countries, but we want to attract hopefully millions into our website. I will challenge individuals to empower themselves and to organize, and it's incredible what's going on. I mean, it's happening.
Will, thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much, Dick.
The explorer Will Steger is making good use of the web as well. He's encouraging people to track his travels on his own website. And you can find photographs and all the links and background information about Will Steger on our website. And our link is thestory.org. Special thanks today to Peter Agre, a former vice chancellor at Duke University, for his help in arranging my chat with Will. And also to David Brower, my colleague here at North Carolina Public Radio, for his reading from Huckleberry Finn. This is a song from Northern Canada that tells the story of an Inuit man who gets in trouble with his elders because he doesn't dress properly for the cold. It's sung by Madeline Alakarialak and Phoebe Atgutaluk. They call themselves Tujat. That's the Inuit name for the settlement of Resolute, and that's where Will Steger's heading on his next polar trek. In just a moment, I'll go back to that series of great misadventures that I started a couple of weeks ago. You know, those times when things go very, very, very wrong, and it's your fault. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. I want to go back to this series of stories we've been hearing about the misadventures we bring upon ourselves. Now, as you listen, try to imagine if you have a contribution to make. And be honest, we all have these major screw-ups under our belts. And I'll tell you a little bit later on how to get your story to me. Last week, you might recall, I talked with Tom Brennan. Tom plans to be an architect, and he thought he could learn a little bit about the construction side of the business in preparation. So he moved from college up north to down south, and as he explained to me, he was having a hard time fitting in. He was making his way, though, until the day he backed a big forklift, called a lull, into the steel structure of a brand new building.
So I drive in, and I boom up the arm, about 20 feet up into the air, extend it out. And then, for whatever reason, as opposed to putting the boom arm back down and then backing out of the entrance, I just threw the lull into reverse and backed out of the building with the lull hanging 20 feet up in the air, this big boom 20 feet up in the air. And I ran into the steel. I just all of us, just the lull just stopped. Boom! I literally sat there, just staring up through the grate of this forklift, just staring for about 30 seconds. I'm fired. And then I sort of, as my gaze dropped from the I-beam directly above me to the catwalk where I had just dropped off this whole load of grout, I see our entire workforce standing there. They're just staring at me.
The interesting part of Tom's story is that he wasn't fired. His boss reviewed the disaster with a line that still stays with me. He told Tom, "If you're not breaking something, you're not doing anything." Kind of wish I had the courage to tell my mother that when I put a hockey puck through the basement window. After Tom told his story, Kevin Haw wrote in with one of his own. He writes, "Regarding your forklift folly story, I thought I'd share the story of the most expensive thing I ever broke." Kevin wrote, "I'm an engineer. Several years ago, I was working as a programmer on a project to add computer controls to the cabin lighting on Boeing 747 and 767 airplanes.
Everyone was working 10 to 20 hours overtime, and I actually had a sleeping bag in my cubicle. And this was during the dot-com boom. You always hear about these extravagant stories. That was not us. We did not have catered meals. We don't have any of this. We did have an open account at a Quickie Mart, a convenience store down the road. Anything, you could just sign for it. So there was a lot
Yippee.
Of junk food.
So you get a Yippee, free slushy yeah. and a microwave hot dog.
That was about it. They did have a pretty good chicken rice soup. But other than that, it was just sad.
But, you know, we talk about this in light terms now, but I suppose when you're in the middle of this project and you're putting in 13, 14-hour days and it's all aimed at trying to get this little lighting computer for the 747 to work, it seems pretty important at the time.
It is pretty important, and Boeing had already sold the plane. I mean, Boeing doesn't build a plane if it's not sold, and because these things are huge, huge assets, and they had already sold tickets for the Virgin flight. This was 10 months in advance. So literally, if we delayed the plane, there were penalties written in the contract, and you could be looking at $500,000, $1 million a day. And this was in the 90s. I don't even know what it is these days.
I'm feeling your stress level going up, though, with all this pressure.
It was. But yeah, there was a lot of pressure. And the other thing is I hadn't realized at the time, or I slowly began to realize, is there was a political issue. There was an image of these guys are cowboys, they don't know what they're doing, and it was really a leap of faith by some people who really did value our work, and we were out to prove that this faith was well-placed.
So, Kevin, you wrote to me about the moment that this prototype was delivered, a big day?
A big day. We had been working with cobbled-together systems and wire wrap boards and wires all over the place, and seriously, the rack laboratory where this stuff looked, it looked like a robot threw up. The wires are just flaying all over the place and components. And we finally got the first prototype from our factory in Mexico. And this thing was about an 8x8x4 box, brushed aluminum drilled with holes, and it had these 5 cables off them. All the hardware guys and mechanical guys have put in thousands of hours of work on this thing.
Ark of the Covenant type reverence for this.
Pretty close. This was not a black label box. This was a red label box, which means it wasn't suitable for flight yet, but it was a big deal. And I'm upstairs, and I'm with my cubemate, Tony, and he says, "Hey, let's go down and take a peek. Everyone's going to be at lunch. Let's go see it." I'm thinking, well, what the heck? I got nothing better to do. You know, I'm going to be here till
I'm sleeping in my cubicle. How exciting is my
exactly? Let's go down. So we sneak into the lab. There it is, and it looked like you described the Ark of the Covenant. It was slick. I mean, it was really nice to see, and it's got all these. It looked like an amputated octopus because there's all these connectors on it. Now these are not like connectors you plug in your wall with your PC or something. These look like fire hoses. They're half an inch thick on the cable part, but the connectors have anywhere from 50 to 120 pins on them. And you clamp them on, you screw them in, and they snap in place. And it's got 5 of these. And Tony, and there's the power supplies, and the whole thing's rigged up. And Tony says, "Hey, let's power it up and see what's going to happen." And I'm all, "But we're not sure how the cables go." And he says, I've looked at the specs. These are all keyed. If you key up pin 2 on this connector and pin 4 on that connector, you can't swap them. There's no way you can screw it up. Well, okay, let's give it a try. And sure enough, I clamp them in place and they just snap right in place. And I was like, oh, first try, that's kind of slick. So let's power it up. So I walk over and I throw the switch. And pop, there's this pop and this curl of smoke from the corner of the box. Oh, you know the smell. Well, you know the sound. You probably know the smell of freshly burning electrical components. And it's acidic and kind of chemical. And it wasn't really strong. I mean, it wasn't like flooding the place. But you know, I slam down the power, and that is the most expensive smell in the world. It beats anything that comes out of a Paris perfumery. It is incredibly expensive.
You fried the prototype.
Yes, I did. And here's what the thing is. It is a prototype. I mean, there is literally not another box like this anywhere on the planet because we're the guys building it. You know, the design work and stuff, it's a few hundred thousand or half mil. And if you're talking about the cost of having this unit down and suddenly 80 to 100 guys, men and women, sorry, not just guys, men and women sitting idle while this thing is fixed, we're talking way out of my pay range.
And all because Kevin and Tony decided to play with a toy that wasn't theirs at lunchtime.
That wasn't theirs. That's exactly it.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Kevin Haw is telling me about the most expensive thing he ever broke. So what did he do next?
Well, Tony's immediate reaction is, we've got to hide it. You know, we've got to, let's get out of here. And I'm thinking, like, Tony, we're not going to hide this. This is not... we're a bureaucracy, but we're not that clueless. I mean, it ain't going to happen. And I will admit, though, his idea had merit. If I hadn't left fingerprints all over the place, you know, of course, maybe that's why he said it. It was my hand on the switch.
What did he have to
lose? My fingerprints. Yeah, exactly. But I know that if this had happened and we had bailed, someone would have assumed sabotage.
Oh, and bring in the private investigators and so
entirely
on and so
possible. Yeah, okay. I mean, they do call in private investigators.
Okay, so what was door number two? If we're not going to just run and hide?
Door number two is the cafeteria, which was about 200 feet away. You know, through some double doors, and I knew that Tom, the electrical engineer who's basically owning this box, who's leading this box through development, is going to be there. So I go into the cafeteria and Tom's sitting there. I think he was eating his tuna fish sandwich. And I go up and I say, Tom, I owe you beer and pizza. And he looks at me, says, why? And I played it right. There was a lot of flattery involved. When I pitched as a puzzle, as, you know, well, what would happen if this cable went to that cable? And I can show you. I mean, I didn't just say that. I mean, after I told him I did.
You didn't walk right in and say, I toasted the prototype, right? You got to that a little slow.
I led up to it, and it was, you know, well, you know the way the prototype's in there, and well, I was kind of wondering what it would be like, and Tony was kind of wondering. We went in, and I had to own up to this.
What was Tom's reaction?
Ticked for probably about 5 or 10 seconds. Then it was a little bit of a panic, but we got to see what the damage is. And he was able to figure out exactly where the 400 hertz high voltage line went in. Eventually, it took him 6 hours to fix this, and he traced it.
Well, wait a second. The thing wasn't completely destroyed.
No, it wasn't. It blew out about four components. He actually brought me the part that had blown out, and it was a little plastic case, again, about half the size of your pinky nail. And it looked like someone had put it on a drill press and drilled a divot. What had happened, it had blown a cone of plastic out. And the microchip inside.
One question. Where's Tony while all this is happening?
You know, he's upstairs. That's a good question. He did cut and run. I think he swung by a couple times. Just wanted to check and see how things are going, give you the moral support. Yeah. The reality is I knew that if this had really hit the fan, it was going to be me. I was senior. My big problem was listening to Tony is what I should have, you know, that was a lapse in judgment on my part.
Well, did you get close to losing your job over this or not?
Not really. Thankfully, Tom was about 4 hours into his repair job. That was the moment that management heard. And we actually had a third level manager swing down and Dave comes by and, so I hear you put in the cable wrong. And well, Tom has it under control. Well, that's good. That's good that Tom has it under control.
So you never got dragged down the hall and dressed down in front of the big boss?
Never did. Not on that one.
we're not going to go
We're not going to go there.
Though. Yeah. So what's the lesson here? That honesty is, in fact, the best excuse after all? Or?
Well, the biggest lesson is don't listen to Tony. The second biggest lesson. Well, the second biggest lesson is in an engineering environment, you're going to do stuff like this. You're going to have screw-ups. The key is you want to try not to do stupid things, but if you're not trying new things, you're not going to build new products.
Well, it's the same thing that Tom Brennan's boss said when he ran his forklift into the building. If you're not breaking something, you're not doing something.
Exactly. If you're not breaking something, you're not building something. And that's actually the thing that inspired me to email you about this.
Does this haunt you, though? I mean, when you're at that final stage of programming something or working on something right now, and you're holding those two wires, and you're going, no, these are the two that go together, aren't they? Do you have that moment of... You know,
tense up when I'm about, whether it's compile something or fire something off or whatever. I always have a little bit of tension. I will say this. I always have a plan B. A good example is I carry a resignation letter, an undated, unsigned resignation letter with me at all times now. And the reason was I was in a later project with the same company and it became a toxic environment. I'm not going to go into real details, but it got very nasty. And I felt powerless because I felt like I can't handle this. I'm going to have to resign. I went home and I typed up a resignation letter and it was undated and all that. And I put it in my notebook. And the next time I dealt with these people, I actually pulled out the envelope and I thought about it. And I said, no, I can handle this for another day. But it gave me a sense of power.
Plan B should be don't listen to Tony.
Yes. Yeah, actually, that's plan A. That's plan A is don't listen to Tony.
Kevin Haas says the good news is that he actually got a 10% raise that year. Kevin's now working as a computer programmer on a naval project in Anaheim. He promises not to plug anything in before it's time. Many of you are familiar with our regular feature called Your Story, a chance for you to tell me about a life-altering event you've experienced, a moment that remains on the highlight reel of your life. Sometimes these moments occur when we're alone, other times in the presence of people much better known than we are. Eric Larson wrote to me about his own brush with fame, about his encounter with the famous anthropologist Jane Goodall. Eric's tale starts when he was caught by a shift in daylight savings time. He was in London and staying at a B&B. And waiting to fly back to America.
And I got down to breakfast for my complimentary breakfast part of the B&B experience, and they were taking up the plates and the food, and I said, whoa, I paid for this, and I'm going to the airport this morning to fly out. I need a good breakfast. And they said, well, breakfast just ended. And I said, well, it's got another hour to it. And they said, oh, you weren't aware of the time change last night. Well, I guess I learned right then that they do daylight savings a little differently in England.
And all of a sudden, you're not thinking of breakfast. You're thinking of the timing of your flight. Right?
I'm thinking, oh, my God. And I really don't know how long it's going to take me to get to Heathrow. It's not like I go to England every day. So I just grab my bags and I go. And I end up in this long security line. And I stay in that line about 15 minutes, realize my flight was going to leave in about 15 minutes. So I rush up to the clerk, the desk. And I get to the counter, and I hear this sort of sweet, nice voice say, excuse me, you've cut in line. And I turned, and I felt pretty ashamed of myself, kind of being the ugly American. And there was this woman who was a bit shorter than me. I gauged her to be in her late 40s, but I think now she was probably in her mid-50s. And in fact, there were suddenly two clerks, and they were both kind of working on our tickets, and I think they both told us really quickly, you know, neither of you is going to make this flight right now. So we got to talking, and I actually didn't recognize her as anyone special, and she asked me where I was from, and I told her I was from North Carolina. I told her where I went to school, and she said, oh, I've spoken there before. And I said, well, on what subject? And she said, chimpanzees. And I started to get an inkling, you know, who I was talking with here, and I knew this was someone I had run across in National Geographic or in some other context who was renowned because I had,
yeah. But did you know her name?
I didn't recall her name until she handed me her card and I saw Jane Goodall, and I said, of course, Jane Goodall.
Was she wearing that sort of classic green khaki shirt that she appears in all her photographs in?
You know, I think she had her fundraiser uniform on, the jet setter who goes
sort of power suit, right?
Yeah, she was more of a power suit than something she'd wear in the bush.
And anything from that conversation, Eric, stick in your mind?
It did. Something did. And we got to talking about what our aims were, and I talked about being a journalist or a writer, and she said, I had the same dream, you know, when I was growing up. I always wanted to write a book. And then she said, but I had a love of animals, and I wanted to study animals too. And I said, well, it seems like you've been able to do both. And she said, well, I've done my bit. And it wasn't in the least, you know, pseudo humility. She didn't wink at me. She didn't. I think she had that true humility that she felt like she had done her bit. And I've often thought about that conversation.
In what way does it affect you today?
I think a lot of us grow up here in America with this notion that we're going to change the world and we save the day. That's the American myth we grow up with. But I think now, you know, looking back on that conversation, I think I have a bit more perspective and realize that perhaps we have less control than we like to think we do.
So in the words of Jane Goodall, doing your bit, I've done my bit, that's something to be proud of.
And it's maybe the most that we can hope for.
And when you look at yourself, have you done your bit or are you still working on it?
Good question. Sometimes I think just keeping a two-year-old alive in the world to see another day is doing my bit, really. And that's the truth. I almost think that I might be viewed as more successful if I just focus on the little things and just doing my job day by day.
That's Eric Larson with his contribution to our file of your stories. If you have a story that I'd be interested in hearing, just get in touch with me through our website at thestory.org or leave me a message on our phone at 1-888-966-9862. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.